One of the biggest changes we see in today's culture is the multi-ethnic nature of the student population. If you're a youth worker, this means that your youth group is probably becoming more multicultural in nature. Ministering to students and families from a variety of ethnic backgrounds requires us to develop cross-cultural sensitivity. How can we best navigate these new waters in our youth ministries? We'll be talking to veteran youth workers, Jody Chung and Danny Kwan, about cross-cultural youth ministry with Asian students and much more on this episode of Youth Culture Matters.
From the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, this is Youth Culture Matters. If you're a parent, youth worker, educator, counselor, grandparent, or anyone else who cares about kids, we're glad you've joined us for this practical, informative, and hope-filled podcast. This is a place where together we talk and think Christianly about the rapidly changing world of today's children, teens, and young adults.
Well, hello again, everybody. I'm Walt Mueller at the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, and welcome to this latest episode of Youth Culture Matters, our podcast here. And Jason, hello. I'll give you a Philly greeting because you're telling me I got to come up with something new. I'll just say, yo, Jason, that old classic Philly greeting. Don't you have something to say to me?
Yo, Walt.
Oh, I thought it was Happy Podcast. I thought that was your signature.
Well, I was
greeting,
trying to switch it up. I'm always up with hashtag Happy Podcast.
There you go.
So,
there you go.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again to everybody for joining us on this one. You're in for a treat today. We're going to talk a little bit later with a couple of friends of ours, Jody Chung and Danny Kwan. Jody is ministering to Chinese students primarily in West Houston, Texas. Danny is working at a Korean church outside of Philadelphia. And we're going to talk about how our culture is changing, how more and more of us are seeing Asian students or students from a variety of other cultures come into our youth groups. And specifically, as we talk about Asian students, what are the things that we need to be sensitive to? How is it best to approach those students? How is it best to approach their parents? And what are some of the specific, nuanced, unique issues that those kids face because of their cultural background? So we're going to have fun with that. But before we do that, Jason, and before we talk about the news, we've got to subject ourselves once more to the question or the quiz. Chris, what do you got?
Just a simple
question for you today.
Doesn't necessarily have to be your favorite. That might be too difficult. But tell us about one of your favorite TV characters of all time and what makes you resonate with them.
Well, that's a good one. That's a good pop culture question. Jason, do you have an answer to that one?
I do. Well, I have to narrow it down. So favorite TV character. Do you have one right away?
He said of all time, and I've got one. It's embarrassing, as always, but I've got one because this is fresh. This is fresh. It's fresh pop culture news. When I was a kid.
Yeah.
And I think sitcoms were great back then. You know, just the old black and white sitcoms, but it was a horse, Mr. Ed. And I'm thinking that because, you know, it was cool as a kid to see a talking horse. And the reason I'm thinking about that is last week.
You saw a talking horse?
No, the star of Mr. Ed died at 96 years old.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about the horse. What was his name? I can't remember his name right now, but we'll come up with that.
No idea.
Yeah, but Mr. Ed, I mean, I have so many favorites. What about you?
Well, since you went old school, I mean, I could go old school and just remembering the old Superman show that would come on. It would come on in the mornings along with cartoons or even before cartoons started. But I'm going to stay new. And it's a character I've really loved to watch over the last two seasons. And it's on Netflix. It's Daredevil. And, I'm a comic book junkie, or at least I was. I'm not so much anymore.
I don't have time for it. Comic book.
No, I some people might think so, but Daredevil is this. It's a really fascinating character, both in the comic book, but specifically with the way that the show has drawn out the character, where there's this inner fight that's always going on between good and bad. Is he good? Is he bad? Every time I watch it, I think, oh, this would be a great sermon illustration. And even this season, as he's encountering other characters from the Marvel universe, it was just a really fascinating character to watch, because he's got a deep faith and is convicted by his faith, but is also engaging in a world that he is making a big difference on, fighting crime, but he still struggles with a lot of that. And you know, he's got codes and absolutes that he does not want to pass, and so I find it really intriguing every time I watch it.
Now, I'm not familiar with that, but you know what? As you talk about that, that would be, it sounds like, a perfect connect that someone who's in youth ministry, who's working with, you know, teens who are into comic books, would be able to use and draw on as a point of, you know, contextualization and
most
illustrations.
Definitely.
So that's neat. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, there was a marvelous and incredible exchange between this whole idea of good and bad, between this season's kind of anti-hero, the Punisher, and Daredevil. And they're on a rooftop, if you've watched it. I mean, my brother-in-law and I watched it, and we were like, wow, that is – if I – were in a youth group right now, that would be a great sermon illustration.
Is this actually an animated series, or is
no? It's not animated. Okay. It's live action. So it, yeah. So
okay.
And then if you're
we'll
an action junkie, they've
we'll
got
let,
their.
We'll let. Yeah. I'm going to check that out. We'll let people know.
Yeah,
about
you should.
That on that, we'll put a link up to that. That's good. By the way, the guy who died recently, Alan Young, 96 years old. He was the star of Mr. Ed, Alan Young. So
wow.
Wilbur was his name in the show, but yeah, Talking Horse. Man, I believed that for a long time. That was, you know, that horse
how
actually
long?
Talked.
How long did
well,
you believe
we
that?
We were probably 2-3 years into our marriage before Lisa let me know that that was not actually real.
Oh.
That horse talked, so. Hey, let's talk about, speaking of talking, let's talk about some of the things that are happening in youth culture. What do you got? What'd you find?
Yeah, so, well, you know, as more and more states are legalizing marijuana, I'm curious as to the impact that that's having. And I
as
think
are many
overall,
parents and youth workers would think about that.
Most definitely. Well, and the other issue, too, is what kind of impact is it having, has it had over the last several years as more and more conversation around marijuana has been brought up? There is some studies or a study that has actually just come out that has looked at the use of marijuana among adolescents. And what they have found is that since 2002, between 2002 and 2013, they saw a decline in the use of marijuana among adolescents by 24%. And they saw that accompanied alongside reductions in behavioral problems, including fighting, property crime, selling drugs, because the researchers found a correlation of the two trends. And I think that this is really interesting, because when you see a drop in one, you see a drop in the other. But it did say this, at the same time, the number of kids in the study who reported having serious behavior problems, much like I just mentioned, getting in a fight, shoplifting, bringing weapons to school, or selling drugs, also declined over the 12-year study. So both, again, correlated. And I think that we have to be careful when we hear information much like this, because we can easily say, well, it's no longer an issue. And I would just say, no, I think this is still an issue. There is a reason that the laws in the states that have legalized marijuana make it 21 and not adolescent. But I also think that there's a reason that we've for a very long time had conversations around the impact that marijuana has had. So I think that we still need to be very careful about and very open about our conversations around this. Although we might have seen a decline, does not mean that it's not an issue. And so I think as I read these, just much like you and I often talk about, although it's pointing to some positives, we still got to be able to point to the impact that having conversations around this issue can have. And it's still very important for us to be aware of.
Yeah, when I first saw this, I looked at this and I was a little concerned about it, because every time we post a story on marijuana and the dangers of it on our CPYU Facebook page, when we tweet a story out or when we put something up on our homepage, cpyu.org. Now, typically, it's with a Facebook page. We get some pushback if anybody who is pro-marijuana or legalization, and I'm not talking about medical marijuana, sees that. So parents need to be aware that there's research coming out on both sides. We really have to check that data. I went back and looked at the monitoring, the future data from the University of Michigan. And and by the way, that's the longest running study. That goes back, I believe, into the 1970s. And just in that time period, Jason, I'm looking, and it's been among 12th graders, the trends in annual prevalence of marijuana use has remained rather stable, anywhere between like 34 to 37%. So it really hasn't gone up or down that much. And for this last year, 34.9, just about 35% of 12th graders, 25.4% of 10th graders, 11.8% of 8th graders report marijuana use in the last year. So it's again, it's still too high. And there's lots of research that points to the long-term effects. Well, let me switch gears here.
Before you switch gears, just real quick, I think it's also important, too, we haven't talked about the impact that it can have on an adolescent's brain. We haven't talked about some of the other things that, that are brought up in a lot of other research about the impact that marijuana can actually have on the brain. So that's also something else that we probably should include in this conversation, or at least suggest that you, if you're listening to this and having questions around it, to at least check, because there are issues that are related to marijuana and the adolescent brain.
And we've posted a lot of news stories about that.
You have. So,
well, here's one, and it goes back to something I harp on all the time, and it's the issue with sleep. And, of course, we've made connections between sleep and social media use. When I say we, I mean people who are researching this. It's not us here at CPYU, but we've talked about it a lot. And when I talk to parents, I let them know, you know, there's a theological reality to all of these issues that we have to look through a theological lens. And God made us, if you go back to Genesis, for a rhythm of work and rest that not only goes throughout the week with 6 days of labor and 1 day of Sabbath, but our bodies need that during the course of a day. And researchers are seeing this. They're saying that children, teenagers need about 9 hours, 15 minutes of sleep for healthy growth and development. Children who are younger, ages six and up to the teenage years, need about 10 hours of sleep. You'll see that figure fluctuate up and down, you know, by a few minutes, depending on who's doing the research and what they're finding. But they're saying now that as our bodies continue to develop, and again, we talk about normal health and growth and development, inadequate sleep, which kids ages six and up are getting, the research is showing that, are associated with a number of health problems, including obesity, declining cognitive functioning, chronic illnesses, and then even depression. And but less than one-third of students report getting 8 or more hours of sleep during the school week, and the total sleep time is decreasing as they look at the statistics from infancy through adulthood. So the message here for parents is you need to monitor sleep and get the smartphones, get the phones, the electronics out of the room, and that goes for parents as well. So we need to be tending to our bodies. Sleep is an act of worship. That's what it is. We need to see it that way, and we need to steward our bodies well.
Amen. Well, I'm glad that you brought that up, because I think that that is a wonderful thing for us to be able to remember. And I think sleep is a wonderful thing, and I'm glad that research is actually showing the importance of it. Well, hey, the next one comes out of the Barna Group, and we've had conversations on this podcast. I'm sure many of our listeners have had conversations around this, but Barna did some research around the end of absolutes, America's new moral code, which I found interesting. Now, I don't know if I would have said I was blown away by it, because it's something that I'm already fairly aware of in the conversations I have, but it says that Christian morality is being ushered out of American social structures, which we know, and off the cultural main stage, leaving a vacuum in its place. Because I think that one of the things that we find is that there is this big void when it comes to a moral code in our culture. I think that in the last year alone, we can point to several examples of how this is taking place in politics, in social media, in pop culture. And so it goes on to ask, so what do Americans believe? And I find that the information that they had is actually pretty fascinating. It says that a majority of American adults across all age groups, ethnicities, gender, socioeconomic status, and political ideology express concern that the nation's moral condition, 8 in 10 overall, is bad. Like, there is a moral condition that needs to be looked at. Now, what is interesting about the study, and what I think that we've got to be paying attention to as Christians, is many people are defining morality different than the morality that we speak of often as Christians. I mean, I think about the podcast we just did with Dennis Hollinger on Christian sexual ethics. Well, then there's Christian ethics in general. And I think that one of the things that we're finding is that the morality that's being defined, because what they say is that the morality that's being defined is much more about the self relative rather than external, say, scripture, right? The truth that we find in scripture, the truth found in God. And so as you dive into what morality is, well, it's being defined by whatever feels good. And I think we need to pay attention to studies like this, because they are having a tremendous impact then, not only on our culture, but also in our church.
Yeah, we've made, as you look at history, we've made a shift from a more, generally speaking, God-centered universe where morality was outside of ourselves to a type of morality now that lies within ourselves and is fluid based on how we feel and what works for us at any given moment in time. And so that's really not morality at all. There's not a constant standard that
Correct.
We can appeal to. And one of the issues that this research from the Barna Group raises is that there are now a sizable number of Americans who see morality as a matter of cultural consensus. Let me just share with you a quote before we move on to the next story.
Yeah,
and
please
I had this in my computer because I found this. It comes from Riley Keough. And do you know who she is? Do you know who she is?
That name's familiar.
Well, she's Elvis's granddaughter, believe it or not. And there's a quote from her that I found recently where she said this: everyone has their own, and by the way, she's a star, okay? So many kids know who she is. Everyone has their own moral code. Unless you're hurting people, who are we to say what's right? And that's just, to me, that's just frightening, because if you have your own moral code, how do you even define whether or not what you're saying or doing is hurting people? And so, by the way, I would throw that quote out to kids and say, well, what do you think? It'd be a great discussion starter on biblical morality. And this is where parents and youth workers need to be teaching right from wrong. Well,
yes.
Here's another story about social media with our Digital Kids Initiative here at CPYU. We talk a lot about social media and the effects that technology are having on us. And we've been tracking for about a year and a half. We actually have a trend alert on this with a thing called Facebook depression, something new. It's not in the DSM, but people are talking about it, that when you're on, basically the gist of it is, when you're on social media, you're defining yourself on social media, you're seeing how you stack up related to everybody else on social media. How do I look? Am I getting enough likes? What are the comments like? What's the quality of the comment, the depth of the comment, the extent of the comments? And so we compare. Teddy Roosevelt once said, you know, comparison is the thief of joy. I think that's very biblical. You know, it's what many call fear of man. And it is idolatry,
yeah,
where we're worshiping something other than the one true God. Well, some research now is saying, then this is coming from Australia, that mothers of young children who spend more time on social media are more likely to report feelings of being anxious and stressed out than their same-aged peers who spend less time on social media. And the research was basically done with the mothers of preschool-aged children, and their levels of self-reported anxiety and stress rose with each additional hour that they spent online. And by the way, women compared to men, women ages 25 to 44 twice as likely to report feelings of anxiety as men. And so it'll be interesting to see where this goes. I have talked, or I've heard from many young mothers who say, when we talk about social media, they'll say, I've got to get off Facebook. It's killing me. And the problem is that not only is it making us anxious and it's stressing us out, but the more we're on there and the more we live through our kids, the more stress it puts on them. So just keep an eye on that. And a message to moms and to dads both regarding yourselves and your kids: really limit your time on there. It is an artificial world, and it is setting standards that are unreachable, and in many ways it's not healthy. I'm not saying get off. I'm saying we need to limit our time. Balance it.
Yeah. It's really interesting that we talk about this, because there has been an even conversation in our own home about boundaries around use of social media and its impact on our family and our family time. And I think that is something that you have to be aware of. And boundaries are really, really important. Well, the last story, I think it's just something that we can utilize, because we spend a lot of time talking about millennials. Sometimes I feel like we speak about millennials and Generation Z, and sometimes it can be in a negative context. But there is a story that I found that talked about how this generation of young people are spending less than any other generation. It might be that they're making less, but it also is something that's highly fascinating. They're doing more with their money is essentially what this study found out. On average, they said that millennials eat out 13 times each month compared to Generation X, who dines out maybe 8 times a month. But they're spending less on each of those dining experiences. Now, it could be that they're comparing dining experiences of fast food versus going to a sit-down restaurant. I'm not exactly sure. But I do find it fascinating, and I do actually watch this among some of the friends that are in these age groups. They're spending less, doing more. And I think that's something that we can actually, practitioners, pay attention to, because I think that's something that's highly fascinating, and it's also something that points to their desire to care for what they have, to care for the things around them. And I always take something like this and say, well, how do we apply this to the work that we're doing? And I think there's good. I will say this. The study did point out that the place where they're spending more money than any other generation, any idea?
Does it have to do with appearance?
No, it doesn't. Actually, they're spending less on clothes but doing more with it. So they're actually getting more clothes, which means they're probably thrift shopping. But coffee. Coffee is what they're spending more on. They cannot go without their caffeine fix. So it's interesting, but I would believe it. Hmm. I would believe it. So yeah.
And that may relate to our story about sleep.
Right? Yeah, that could have a tremendous influence.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you this. I'm getting excited for today's guest.
Well, before we move into that, can I tell my story?
You have a story.
Well, I told
yes,
you.
Yes, I would love to hear your story.
I want to end this with a story, not a news thing, because this follows up on something that we talked about on a past podcast. Do you remember when we were talking about there was a news piece that came out? We were talking about when kids get cell phones. And this survey said that 53% of children have a cell phone by the time they reach their 7th birthday. Do you remember us talking about that?
Yeah.
I actually incorporated that into a quiz I did at our CPYU banquet and fundraiser, where I was working to raise the awareness of the people who were there about some trends in youth culture. So I ran last week into a young mother of a first grader. I ran into her, Lisa and I did it at Costco, and she was talking about the banquet, and she said, "Hey, I need to tell you something. You remember that slide you put up about the kids and cell phones by the 7th birthday?" She said, "I did not believe that." Well, last week, she tells me, I go on a field trip. I'm one of the room mothers. I go on a field trip with my first grade daughter. We were told ahead of time, a letter went home, and I guess there were three or four classrooms that went. A letter came home and said the kids on this field trip will be allowed to bring their electronics on the bus. So she gets on the bus, and she observes on the way to and from. She said, "I'm going to tell you, these are first graders, all right? So it's age 6, 7. She said 90% of the kids got on that bus with their devices. Every single one that I asked if it was their device or a parent's device, every single one said it was their own phone. They proceeded to show her what they were able to do on those phones. Many had internet access. Many had the ability to take, send, and receive photos," which to me is just ludicrous when you think about the problems with sexting and developmentally where kids are at and the kind of trouble they can get in. She said that the 10% that didn't have phones, do you know what they were doing while they were on the bus? Looking over the shoulders.
Looking over
of the 90% who did, probably with great interest and jealousy and heartache. And this is what else she told me. She told me that the whole way to and the whole way from the bus was absolutely quiet. because the kids were not interacting with each other. They were buried in their devices. All of the room mothers, with the exception of her, were sitting in the front. They were chatting back and forth. She decided to sit with her own child who did not have a device. They sat with another young child who didn't have a device, and they conversed the whole way. When the field trip was over, one of the other moms on the bus said to this mom, who relayed the story to me, "That was beautiful how you sat back there and you were talking to your kids," as if it was an anomaly or something that doesn't come easy or something that is just so rare. So I just share that because this is where we're at. You know, we've talked for a long time about where we're going. This is where we're at. These are the kinds of things that we're dealing with. So
that's crazy. You know, I think about the influence that tech has, how often we talk about it, you know, and especially with the work that I do with regards to sex and sexuality, specifically pornography, and the access that a young person has to pornography. And it's not a matter of them finding it. It's a matter of pornographers finding them.
Yeah.
And whether we like to admit this or not, one of the places that pornographers target are young boys, young girls from the ages of 5 to 9. I mean, that's – and the reason is not because they are sexually aroused, but because they are curious.
Yeah.
And I think that this is something that we have to be really diligent in our homes in having both conversations and protection around, because – yeah, access to these phones at that age with internet access, I don't always like to ring the alarms, but you're essentially handing them a device that will at some point show them pornography.
Hey, this is the reality, and this is where, you know, I think we need to be very direct with what we know, very direct in communicating that to parents and youth workers. Youth workers who are listening, you need to talk about these matters.
Yes.
With parents. Most of them are ignorant to this, and yep, there's numerous reasons for ignorance, but you need to make them aware, because I've actually started to use less the terminology that this stuff is life-shaping, because the reality is, and this is why we have a sexual integrity initiative, Jason, it is life misshaping. It misshapes our lives, and it misshapes our sexuality. So just a story I wanted to communicate.
Thank you, Walt. Well, I am still excited about who we've got coming on. It's gonna be a good conversation. I think Danny and Jody are gonna enlighten us and allow for us to have some good opportunity to understand culture and its influence, specifically Asian culture, because we have a growing number of students that are entering into our youth ministries that we may or may not understand, and I think that this is one of those conversations that we need to engage.
Good.
So I'm glad that we're doing this. This is going to be a really fun and interesting interview.
Yep. Well, stick with us, folks, and we'll be right back after this break. Here at the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, we want to help you stay up to date on today's youth culture. One of the tools we've developed to keep you current is our weekly Youth Culture E-Update. Delivered to you by email, our Youth Culture E-Update comes to you in a format that allows you to easily scroll through and quickly choose those stories and resources that will be most helpful to you in your particular setting. To sign up for this free resource, go to our website at cpyu.org, scroll down to the bottom of the page, and enter your email address in the tab marked E-Update Sign Up. It's that simple. Well, welcome back, everybody, to this episode of Youth Culture Matters. And I'm really excited, Jason, about what we're going to talk about today, because this is something that I think as our culture develops and we become more mobile and globalized, in fact, kind of old-fashioned to say that because those things have already happened, the face of youth ministry is really changing in terms of the types of kids that we have come into our youth groups culturally. It's no longer just subcultures of kids that are built around interests, but actual subcultures that are built around ethnicity. And certainly, you know, one of the things that we've seen happen is just a growth in the population in many, many youth groups in terms of Asian kids. And so I've had the opportunity over the last few years to spend some time with one of my mentors, Gary Parrott at Gordon-Conwell, who actually has done a lot of ministry, youth ministry in Korean churches, and has worked to develop an awareness and a sensitivity in his students, myself included, which has led to a lot of questions and just trying to figure this all out. And so what we've done today, Jason, is invite a couple of my friends, Danny Kwan and Jody Chung, to talk about this. Danny is actually in Horsham, Pennsylvania, and he's ministering at a Korean church there, the Yongsang PCA Church in Horsham, Pennsylvania, doing youth and family ministry. Danny has a PhD from Eastern University, and he's married. And Danny, you have three kids. Are they all teenagers?
They are teenagers and all in my youth group.
Okay. At home at church, great. Right?
Yes, it's the worst nightmare for my boys.
Yeah, and it's three boys. You have three boys? Yeah, okay, great. So Danny has Danny's really well known in our youth ministry world in terms of doing ministry in Korean churches, really is a leader there and has a lot to say to all of us who are doing youth ministry, regardless of ethnicity. And then Jody Chung, who is a newer friend of mine. Marv Penner and I got to go down to Houston, Texas, and we were a part of doing the Tackling the Tough Stuff seminar at Jody's church just a couple of months ago. Jody is at the West Houston Chinese Church. She's working with a whole group of Chinese churches in the area, and Jody has a Master of Divinity degree from Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary, so she and I really connected fast. And then she's married to a great guy, Mike Chung. By the way, that's for another podcast. We'll do a whole story on how people meet and get married, but that was fun to hear that story.
Yeah.
And you have two amazing little kids, Coleman and Noel, who I had a chance to eat lunch with. And so, Jody, I'm glad you're here. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Good. So, Jason, where you are and with what you're doing with Project 619, as you get into the schools there in the Northwest, I'm just going to guess, we haven't talked about this, but you're encountering a larger Asian population there, and if so...
Well, most definitely.
Yeah, what kind of sensitivities have you had to develop in order to speak to that?
Yeah, well, that's it's one that we're still developing. And I think one of the things that being in the Pacific Northwest, especially as we move more towards Seattle, questions around Asian culture are ones that, honestly, I'm largely ignorant to. And I am learning, just as we are going to do today, which I'm really excited that we're doing this. I think that this can be actually a really wonderful opportunity for not only myself, ourself, but also I think for our listening audience to really engage some, I think, important questions around sensitivity and around understanding. So I'm really excited for us to dive into this conversation.
Good. Well, let me start with Jody because, you know, we were just down at the West Houston Chinese Church, Marv Penner and myself. And here's what's great. You know, Marv and I have probably 80 years of youth ministry experience between us, but we go down there and, well, even before we got there, we had asked some questions and Jody and her team were very gracious in answering those questions about the culture. And then when we got there, making us aware of some things. And it's just so hard to get it. It's a different world in so many ways. Jody, what do we need to know as youth workers? What do we need to know about Asian kids, Asian families, and in particular in the Chinese culture? What do we need to know about the culture to be more effective in ministry?
Well, yeah, that's a really great question. I think one of the difficult things for our Asian families in youth ministry is communication. I mean, one of the things I think for your Tackling the Tough Stuff team that might have been different is I asked them if I could have all their outlines ahead of time to get them all translated. Mm-hmm. Because really, a lot of our parents, they're home language, their heart language is Chinese. And it's really difficult sometimes to convey in English, you know, what you want to get across when they're, you know, from a Chinese background. So I really appreciated just getting those materials, getting them translated. But also there's the whole idea of direct communication and indirect communication that is even tricky for me because I'm an American. I mean, I grew up in America, and working in a Chinese American church, I have to learn how to communicate, how to listen, because we don't always say things directly. And so you kind of have to read between the lines sometimes and really take the time to build the relationship. Because sometimes when you're just talking to them, they may not tell you straight up what they're feeling. But as you get to know them, as you spend time with the parents, then their feelings and their true hearts come out. So I think that's another thing. Another thing about Asian culture is our priorities. So we really value academic success. We value also being well-rounded, especially as families are becoming more accustomed to the American culture. Mm-hmm. Success is a huge value. And so they're seeing that it's not just about academics. It's about sports. It's about having this really great, well-rounded resume. And so that definitely competes with church events at times. Mm-hmm. So for example, we never have anything during the weekday. Like Wednesday night Bible studies is something we never do. And I know a lot of more predominantly Caucasian white churches, they have Bible studies on Wednesday nights. Well, that wouldn't work. We do it on Friday night. And kids are only allowed to come to fellowship on Friday nights after they've done their Chinese school homework for Saturday morning Chinese school. You know, that's just sort of the value system that we are operating with. So those are just some things to... I think that are helpful to know.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, if you're going to have fellowship and you're having it midweek, maybe that's why a lot of Asian Americans aren't showing up, because they're really focused on school those days.
Yeah. And you're talking there, when you talk about parents, I know it's probably the same with Danny. You probably have a lot of, am I using the term correctly, first generation parents?
Yes.
And then when we talk about our kids, they're trying to figure out really who they are, because they're straddling multiple cultures as teenagers, as second generation kids. Danny, are you finding the same thing with parents, you know, where you are in the Korean culture?
So, you know, again, communication priorities, totally agree with Jody. That's a big priority in the Asian culture. And I can give an example from like Korean churches in Pennsylvania versus Korean churches in California. And maybe even Jason, you're talking about the term Asian. Like, you wouldn't call all your white Caucasian kids Europeans.
Yes.
I think just the term Asian kind of precludes the great variety in different cultures, Chinese and Korean, Vietnamese, Japanese. So, you know, as Caucasian youth workers, I think it's important to understand that there's a rich variety and diversity even within the idea of Asian or Asian American kids. And that's something to be sensitive of, ethnic cultural diversity. And then, you know, what Jody said, I totally agree with, again, priorities, education, communication. And what I'm finding, again, like Korean churches in California, they're on their second and third generation of parents and kids. I've been at my church for 21 years. I know, you know, people call me a unicorn because that's not true for youth workers, but I've seen this shift of, you know, the first generation parents, and now I'm seeing parents who are more acculturated to America, understand a little bit more of the things about this culture. And so, like, used to be academics was why they couldn't come to church, and now sports is also just as big of a reason, because, again, my parents, they never came to my Little League games. They never came to my football games on Friday night. But, you know, soccer, fall soccer, travel soccer. So this variety and diversity is also coming, I think, not only ethnically with the rich variety of Asians, but also in the sense of culturally. Our Asian culture is shifting. And, again, it's not necessarily just the old school first gen values. So, yeah, I'd really commend, you know, again, with white being our dominant culture in America, you know, we don't think of it as a cultural group. We think of, you know, I teach a course, youth ministry across culture. I say by nature, youth ministry is across culture, where we're reaching across adolescents. At the same time, with the variety of Asian cultures that we really need to be sensitive that, you know, white is a culture and black is a culture and Asian is a culture. And so we are cross-cultural missionaries in that way, too. It's just that with the white culture, we just take it for granted. And I'm just saying and encouraging youth workers who are, you know, maybe not Asian, that, hey, this is a great way to think about that. As you, much as you doing it naturally with your own predominant white culture, you know, to be sensitive as cross-cultural missionaries, that you're reaching across a vast differences in ethnicity and cultural and generational. And again, even with our parents, again, some of my parents are still real first generation, as Jody talked about. And again, I think that contrast between academics and sports and the reason for missing church for me is a classic example of the shifting in my own church of even the differences of the type of parents we have and more culturally to America.
Jody, are you seeing that as well with the sports and the academics? You know, that the sports are actually, which is a very North American thing, you know, how we worship and idolize sport. So that's actually, because I've always understood the academic part in the Asian cultures as being what was at the forefront. But now you're seeing that as well with your students down there and families?
Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah. Sports, even band.
Band
majors, mm-hmm. and that takes up a lot of time. And I think, you know, there's so many cultures represented in our youth groups nowadays, or increasingly, or in our society, and yet we still have a lot of identity issues. Yeah. I think one of the big things that I face in Asian American youth ministry is sort of the identity of living in the between.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're especially second gen, right? So the first generation Chinese immigrants, like my parents, they brought over their culture. And then I grew up in America. So I feel strongly towards both. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love Chinese food. I really like the language sometimes. I mean, I like hearing it. I don't always like speaking it growing up. But there's a fondness there. And yet I'm drawn towards the American culture and wanting to fit in. Mm-hmm. And so I think that just emphasizing our identity in Christ and addressing head on these identity issues of what is it like to live in the between, which maybe the majority culture may not understand so clearly, is important.
Yeah. Let me ask you guys about, I want to ask you about parents real quick, because you talked about, Jody, you talked about communication with parents, and I think you used the terms direct and indirect. So I'm thinking back, and Danny, by the way, has done some great work with parents. He's actually written a book called A Youth Worker's Field Guide to Parents, Understanding Parents of Teenagers. And I think people who are in youth ministry who have Asian kids from whatever Asian culture coming in need to work really hard, not just to understand parents of teenagers, but understand how the Asian parenting experience and expectations are shaping interactions and conversations. So give me an example, and Jason, so if you ever get to go speak at the West Houston Chinese Church or any other Asian church, you might expect this, but had a conversation with a parent. I'll just say it was a mom who had a dilemma, and when she shared with me the dilemma, she was very hesitant to share it. And when she shared it not in the first person, but in the third person. She didn't want me to know it was, you know, hitting really close to home. It was sort of like that, you know, when someone comes up and says, I have a friend who is struggling with a problem. And, you know, she was rattled, obviously, and she wasn't alone. I mean, we hear this from everybody wherever we go. We have these conversations with parents, but it was just different there. And I think, Jody, you had explained to me a little bit about shame in the Chinese culture with families. And I don't know if it's the same, Danny, in the Korean culture, but talk a little bit about that and how a youth worker who is not familiar with that, who is not raised in that, who is not steeped in that, can best navigate that and respond to that.
Yeah, you know, I think that that mom who is talking to you may not have wanted to admit that could have been her child.
Yeah.
Because that's shameful to have a kid who is struggling with depression or struggling in general, we want to, and I think a lot of people understand that, is that we want to put out our best in front of people. Public face is important. We call it face, right?
Yeah, right.
How you appear in public is important. And so I think it impacts us because we need to be respectful. I think shame and respect go hand in hand. When we are ministering to our families, we have to understand and treat them as authority, treat them as people to be respected. And if you have an issue with their kids, is really to go about it in a different way. It's probably not the best to say it when other people are around, you know, and be bringing them private.
That's good advice.
Talk to them from a loving perspective and say, hey, you know, and from a listening one, can you tell me how you're doing? Yep. You know, I think some of this is pretty practical as
sure.
well.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, shame, just again, in a bigger context, is, you know, it's a non-Western value. So, again, as a, I grew up bicultural like Jody, too. I grew up most of my life here. So, you know, but I still have this part of me that understands shame so deeply. And but it's not a, I think in the West here, it's not a natural understanding of being more open and talking about things. When I talk about the variety of parents, for example, asking parents to seek counseling, it's a very shameful task.
For, right.
Tell the parents, your child needs counseling, you need counseling. I'm seeing now more with younger parents or parents who are a little bit more westernized or have grown up here, they're more open to counseling. But even that idea of going somewhere and seeking help, losing face, worried about people knowing you're having struggles in your family is extremely difficult. Again, it's hard to understand shame unless you're Asian, I think, in a lot of ways. And that we do navigate it carefully. A student's missing 3 mission team meetings in a row, and I have to go talk to the parent. And the first reaction is, oh, I'm going to get so angry at my kid, or you've embarrassed me, versus, hey, I'm here for your child. I really want them to have a great mission trip. They really need to come to the meeting. But again, a lot of times parents are like, oh, you embarrassed me. They're, you know, and I have to be very delicate about that. But again, there's a whole rich variety of parenting that is changing. But yeah, I agree with Jody that shame is still a big aspect of our culture and Asian culture.
So playing upon this idea of shame, one of the things that, as I'm listening to you, the question that I'm having is, there seems, so there's structure. Structure is important. There are certain priorities. And I just wonder how that plays out theologically with students that are first generation, and then those that have moved here from somewhere else and are more accustomed. And so you're talking academics, sports, and I'm just thinking some of the interactions that I've had is I see the bump up against the first generation, the ones that have grown up here and the ones that moved here. And they're almost around, like, with regards to the work that we do, one wants to be like, no, around the issues of, like, sex and relationship. And they're very clear, black and white, whereas their sons and daughters are trying to navigate this in a different way. They're wearing their faith in a different aspect. Is that, would that be a fair assessment? And how do youth workers navigate that, if that is a fair assessment?
You know, I think what Jody said about two cultures, this bicultural identity,
yeah.
You know, it's hard to pinpoint and narrow it down into one kind of classification, but definitely they're just struggling between two cultures. I mean, even kids who have been here longer, they're always going to look Asian. And so naturally they're going to still have bicultural identity struggles. Just looking in the mirror, you're going to say, am I Asian or am I American? And again, those kind of issues, faith-wise, shame-wise, and it's a whole spectrum of where you are on the assimilation scale or the bicultural scale. And this is social science research on biculturalism that, again, there's a whole kind of tension that you're continually adding your life and depending on how old you are and, 15 versus 18 and again, these issues that you're mentioning, it's so hard to place it neatly in categories. And I just look at it as a rich variety and spectrum that a journey that a kid is going to be going on. And again, youth workers cannot just say, oh, you're Asian, shame. Oh, you're Asian, culture. You know, but again, even within this specific context of Asian and biculturalism, man, kids are on whole different spectrums and places in their journeys. And as you minister to, non-Asian students, you know, you're going to be sensitive to their personal journeys and where they're at. And that's a big suggestion for me, that you really have to find out their specific story. And even when I wrote the book, I wrote about understanding parents of teenagers. I wrote it for a general audience. It's not a book about Asian culture, but a lot of my stories are from my church. But I think any youth worker will understand, the issues that I wrote about. And again, I wrote it for a more general audience. But again, it was stories from my situation. And an American kid will struggle with bicultural identity, maybe in a different way. But again, there is always that. Again, so I want to make it general, but also very specific. And that's kind of what I'm suggesting.
Hey, Danny. And we need to take a break here. But before we go to the break, and I have a question for both of you when we come back. But as I'm sitting here listening to you talk, and I'm thinking about where you're doing ministry in Horsham, Pennsylvania, I grew up. My high school years were spent in a home that's literally 2,500 feet from your church, from the front door of your church, which wasn't there. By the way, when I was in high school, I graduated from Upper Dublin High School in 1974. I lived right on the border between Upper Dublin and Hapro-Horsham. But just how much the world's changed, I'm just going to tell you this, and I want you to respond to this. Yeah. When I went to high school at Upper Dublin and I graduated in 1974, we had at Upper Dublin one Asian American person. And it was it was a family. There were four kids. The one was in my class. And they were actually from our church there at Supplee, and they were a Japanese American family. Mm-hmm. Now, you tell me you've got students from Upper Dublin now, right?
Yep.
So
yep.
What percentage of the population at that high school would you say is Asian?
So can I say one thing
on
that? Even more awesome, we have a Korean American school board member at Upper Dublin now.
Okay.
I think that's huge progress.
Is that you?
No, it's not me.
All right, okay.
I live in Horsham.
I know.
But I think that's great that they've elected a Korean-American 1.5 school board member who's bringing perspectives and teaching not only for the Korean-American and Asian-American population, but also educating the general school district about some of these issues. And I think that's a huge change and a sign of the times in itself.
Yeah. What would you say the population is, though, percentage-wise, at either Upper Dublin or where you are in Hapro-Horsham, suburban
Horsham,
Philadelphia?
Horsham, I would say, just Korean-Americans. I mean, I have a youth group of about 200. I have about 50 kids in our Horsham school district.
Wow.
From my own youth group. And say in the graduating class this year, there's about 350 kids. Just from my church, I have 14 graduates from Horsham High School. And again, the general Korean, I'm not sure, but again, 14 out of 300 just from one church is quite a big population.
And this is why this conversation is important, because in our youth groups, we've got these multiple cultures coming in, and we need to be sensitive to this. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to follow up with a question on life for Asian teenagers. What do we need to know? What do we need to be sensitive to in terms of how life is nuanced and perhaps more difficult for Asian teens? What's being piled on the normal teenage experience in today's youth culture that makes life tougher for Asian teens? We're talking to Jody Chung and Danny Kwan about ministry to Asian students, and we'll be right back after this break. Here at CPYU, we're taking steps to help parents, youth workers, educators, and anyone else who cares about kids help the kids they know and love navigate the difficult issues of life. We've put together a one-day training seminar called Tackling the Tough Stuff that we can bring to your community. Over the course of the day, Mark Penner and I will provide information and practical steps you can take to address narcissism, pornography, self-injury, depression, suicide, and a variety of other tough issues kids face in today's world. To learn more about bringing Tackling the Tough Stuff to your church or community, go to cpyu.org/toughstuff or call us at 1-800-807-CPYU.
Well, welcome back to this podcast as we're both talking to Jody Chung and Danny Kwan here with Walt Mueller. And as always, we like to start this section of our podcast with a few questions that Walt has put together. So, Walt, I'm going to hand it over to you.
Nothing
what are your five
here.
Questions?
Yeah,
yeah, this is going to be good for Danny and Jody.
All right, Danny and Jody, here we go. And I'll just ask these questions 1 through 5. This is just a way to get to know you, have some fun with it. And sometimes we get good recommendations for things to do in our lives as you answer these questions. In all honesty, sometimes you'll steer us away from some things too, based on your poor choices. But here are the questions. And all right, let me see here. I don't have them numbered today. All right, here's the first one. What do you hate the sound of? What do you hate the sound of? Kenton's laughing. That sounds like a question Kenton would ask. Is there any sound you just find deplorable, reprehensible? You can't stand it. And try not to name individual people. Do you have a sound? You guys look stumped. Go ahead. Who wants to go first? Just a sound you don't like. This is falling apart very quickly here.
No. Well, the first thing that came to mind is just little kids screaming. You know, I used to be one of those parents one of those people that thought, oh, I am never going to, my kids are never going to scream in public, you know, and now my kids scream all the time. And I think it's just as irritating when you have your own kids as other kids. Yeah.
Isn't it
just
funny how all our expert parenting advice just totally disappears once we have children and become parents? Yeah, that's what happens.
And they're screaming.
Yeah, Danny, what's your sound?
I thought I'd get used to it, but I'm not.
As a pastor of families, but also youth, I'm still a youth pastor at heart. And my boys will be okay with this, but when they sit on the toilet and I hear that sound coming out of their body, I'm just like, it's going to be a big mess. I'm going to have to clean it up.
That's you had to go there, Danny.
Yeah.
I mean, my wife and I, it sounds like a trombone just going off.
Well, I guess that now, all right, let me cross that question off. Don't ever ask that question again.
You're a youth
pastor. Okay, I hear that. And by the way, just your answer there gives us a little more insight into borders and boundaries in the Korean culture about what's proper and what's not. So, all right, okay. So, all right, here's the second one. What was your favorite TV show growing up? You have a favorite TV show growing up? Danny, what do you got?
I used to love The Cosby Show. I can't say that proudly now because of, Bill Cosby and Phil and everything.
Yep.
Used to love watching it.
Yeah,
it was great.
Great life lessons there. Jody, favorite TV
show
growing
up? Well, I grew up with an older brother, and so we always used to watch The Incredible Hulk.
Okay.
I loved the Hulk.
That's it. Yes. Yeah, that's a good one.
Bruce Banner.
All right. I wouldn't have been able to name that name. I just would have totally forgotten that. All right. What part of pop culture do you wish would just go away? What part of pop culture do you wish would just go away?
It's a good one.
Yeah, you love it all, don't you? The silence is killing me here. This is not a test, guys. You can just whatever comes to mind.
The Pittsburgh Steelers.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, that's a great answer.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, yeah, that's good, Danny. All right. And Kenton's wearing his Pittsburgh Steelers shirt. You know, he must not have had anything that was clean, so he just pulled that out, put that on today. Jody, you got an answer to that one?
I think some of the fashion choices that you see on music award shows is, we don't need that.
Boy, this is going to be an issue for you in your ministry with girls, too. I mean, anybody who's ministering to girls has that problem. All right. Last book you read from cover to cover. I know both you guys like to read, so, and we love reading recommendations. So last book you read from cover to cover.
Man, oh man.
I read Hold On to Your Kids by Gabor and Mott. I think they're authors. I don't know if you're familiar with them. It's about parenting. And my kids are adopted, so I read an adoption book from cover to cover.
Okay,
that's the last one.
Great. Good. Danny?
It's going to sound nerdy, but Preaching by Tim Keller. I thought it was a great book.
That's
Preaching.
Not nerdy at all.
Okay,
anything
good.
That guy writes is worth reading. So
Yes. That's a big fan.
All right, one more question. And, Danny, I think I know your answer to this one. But what sports team do you love to see lose?
Love to see lose?
Yeah.
For me, it's definitely the Dallas Cowboys.
Oh, all right.
Even though we might lose, it's always greater to see them losing.
I'm with you. Yeah I'm a fellow Eagles fan, so.
Yeah.
Now, remember, Jody's in Texas, but I'm not sure who she.
Man, I'm going to have to defer to my husband, Mike, on that. So
okay.
I just, whoever he doesn't like, he loves to see lose.
Yeah, so you're not a big sports fan.
No, not
okay.
so much.
Well, that's all right. That's good. All right, so we got to know you a little bit, and I share, Danny, I just want to say I have to say this again, the Steelers. And I have so many friends in Pittsburgh, but for some reason, I don't know what it is. You know, I think I was bullied by Steelers fans when I went out there for college.
You know,
that's
really interesting, Walt, because I was thinking the Phillies. So
I knew it was going to come back to baseball. And yeah, I watched a part of a great documentary last night on Bartman and the Cubs.
Oh, yeah,
so,
Catching Hell.
That was really good. So
yeah,
all right, well, let me shift
me
gears. Let's go back to our discussion. We're talking to Danny and Jody about ministry to Asian students and the whole reality of first generation, second generation. And let me ask this question. As a youth worker, what do I need to know about what life is like for Asian teens here in the United States? And specifically, is life harder? I mean, life is hard for teenagers. Is life harder for Asian teens, you know, nuanced? And if so, how? What do we need to be aware of with those kids who come into our youth groups?
I think there's a lot of pressure that Asian teens have. I don't know if it's more or less. Some of our Asian teens go to high schools and junior highs that are very diverse. Mm-hmm. But I know that when I grew up, I was one of three Chinese kids, you know, and there were like two African-American, and the rest were all white. So I faced a lot of pressure, I think, just being different.
Yeah.
But I think the pressures that our kids face, a lot of it comes from home because Asian parents tend to be critical.
Yeah.
And they tend to push their kids pretty hard. So I don't know if you've heard of this. Like, what's the Asian F? Do you know, Danny?
I don't want to say it, but no, go ahead.
It's like an A-, right?
Yeah,
that's the Asian F. So kids are not even allowed to get A-. They want to get, you know, the straight A's, A+, and that's just standard expected of them. So I think there's just that. And I think parents really want their kids to succeed. Maybe as new immigrants, they had to work hard.
Right.
So I think it's actually a really great core value to instill in your kids: hard work, high standards. But sometimes it could put a lot of pressure on kids, especially if they don't find themselves measuring up.
Danny.
I mean, even like we talked about the rich variety of parents, you know, first generation versus a little bit more acculturated and Americanized. I'm finding that the more Americanized parents who are Asians, at least in my church, but I think generally, they know both cultures. So they're pressuring their kids not only with all the Asian stuff that they grew up with, but a lot of the American stuff too, and team sports, band you talked about, Jody, and getting involved in high school, and they know the college application process. My parents just gave me a check and said, send off your college application, but these parents are even, you know, not only tiger parents, but super tiger parents, because they know, like, the how to get into college and what you need to do. So, again, I think it's almost worse for the more Americanized parents and for the Asian kids of those parents.
Yeah, let me ask a follow-up. Go ahead, Jody.
No, and then you couple that with just not being able to be very vulnerable.
Yeah.
And very honest and open about what you're struggling with, because we don't necessarily have the role models in Asian culture of how to open up with our feelings towards one another at home. Yep. And so if you're not doing that at home regularly, you're likely not going to do that with your youth pastor or sure. with your youth leaders. So they might be struggling, but then you wouldn't know about it. And so just that silence that they live in.
Can I add one more thing?
Yeah, please, Danny, go.
You know, and we're seeing also parents who have grown up here. So they're immigrant parents who've lived a very chaotic immigrant lifestyle, survived. So these are the kids. As they've become parents now, they've never actually grown up in a stable environment. They've grown up with immigrant mm-hmm. parents. So when they become parents, a lot of them are not equipped to be parents, or they haven't lived in a stable parental environment as kids, immigrant kids. And so, you know, I've been there at my church for 24 years, so I'm seeing these shifts. This year I'm going to have my first child of a former youth kid mm-hmm. in my youth group. Very excited, you know, a child of a former, you know, youth kid. But again, you know, when they become parents, they haven't grown up in a stable. You know, our parents did great. You know, they worked hard 14 hours a day.
Yes.
And, you know, but again, we grew up in less stable environments, not a bad environment. But again, when we become parents, we might not even know how to parent well either.
Wow. You're talking a little bit about the idea of vulnerability, sharing. I'm just really curious if I can just even pinpoint. So we do a lot of work around discussions around pornography and some of those things. So like if I'm just really wondering for an Asian student that might be looking at something as specific as pornography, and we're in the church, I'm speaking and saying we need to find ways to have conversations about this, to be vulnerable. Yeah, how does that sit? Like, how is that received? How does a youth minister specifically to some of their Asian students when they're saying be vulnerable, share, and they're kind of bumping up against some of the there's these different aspects. So I'm just really curious how that might play out and suggestions that you would make as a practitioner listening to this is engaging in their students, Asian students specifically on this.
I think one of the most important things is really ministering to families, ministering to the parents. So I'm trying to switch a lot of my focus, not just on the kids, but teaching parent classes. You have to go back to educating our parents on what kind of culture these kids are growing up in. Again, I'm speaking from a perspective of most of our parents are first generation immigrants. Mm-hmm. We don't have as many second and third gen.
Yeah.
So these first generation immigrants, they want me to tell them about what American high school is like, what American colleges are like, and that experience. And then I tell them about what kind of parenting honors God. What is biblical parenting?
Mm-hmm.
So we go through stages. Like, you know, when you're young, you cater to them from like age 0 to 2. And then you go to the controlling stage where you're really doing things for them, teaching them. But then when you get to the preteen stage, you have to move into coaching to give them that more independence, help them to become. I love Walt Mueller's quote. He said, our job as parents is to make them more independent from us and dependent on God. That movement. And so the coaching phase is important for that. Unfortunately, and then you go into caring phase when they go off to college. But unfortunately, a lot of our Asian parents stay in the controlling phase, you know, from 2 to 22. You know, they're in that for a long time. So I think it goes back to the basics of how we parent and then talking to them about the issues of pornography and how we talk to our kids about that and why it's important. So it's like a whole package. So I don't think we can just straight up go to our youth groups and our parents and say, this is what it is, without first having a context.
Sure. And, you know, there is a great opportunity in that way to we're not replacing the parents as youth workers. We believe that 100%. We're not replacing them. But because communication is so lacking, sometimes something like pornography, gay, lesbian issues, really being authentic and open with our kids, you know, the old relational model of youth ministry. I think it works well in Asian culture, you know, earn the right to be heard, because we're not the parents, but we can provide a place where we can mentor and coach and be authentic and be someone open that maybe they see in their American friends they have that. So I really do believe that relational aspect is a key to speaking into something like pornography and such. And earlier, I know Jody talked about this too. It kind of relates to this, but what's harder for a teenager in the Asian context and even for us as youth workers, Judy and I, she said she had to translate everything into Chinese, Walt, when you came to speak. And, you know, at Fuller, they're talking about sticky faith and intergenerational worship. And my comment to them is it's great, you know, but we have to take it another step further. We have to, like, translate everything for intergenerational worship. We have to translate the praise songs. We have to translate the sermons. So it's a whole other level and difference and difficulty for kids because there's a language barrier. But even as youth workers and even thinking about ministering to parents, we have this level of overcoming a language barrier, which is also a cultural barrier that makes it unique and a different level of ministry to our kids and our parents.
You know, when I was a teenager, I'm thinking back to this, that my, you know, with adolescent development and, you know, as you're developing your sense of self, middle school, high school, the hallways were, they were a tough place for me. And I think they were a tough place for most people right. because you're trying to figure out who you are trying on different selves, you wonder if you fit in. And I remember when the last bell would ring and I'd head out of the building and go home, I'd breathe almost literally a sigh of relief. You know, oh man, I'm on my way home. That's a safe place. As I listen to the two of you talk, it makes me wonder if the experience for many of the Asian students is really different because of these unique factors that you're bringing up, in the sense that the school and the peer group can actually wind up being a more powerful life-shaping influence because it is a safer place for them where they feel a greater sense of belonging than perhaps the home. Am I hearing you right if I think that? Is that the case? Now, granted, we know that for students in general, if home is chaotic because the marriage is bad or there's abuse or things like that, but would what you're describing in the Asian culture with, you know, the difference between first and second generation and trying to navigate all these, you both used the word pressures, is it a tougher place? In other words, where do Asian students want to retreat to? Where do they go to retreat? Do they find it more in the school or do they find it more in the home? Maybe that's an unfair question because it's a blanket statement, but respond to that. Am I on to something there or am I misreading things?
Well, actually, you bring up a good point that I think we haven't talked about is one of the things I like about Asian cultures is our value of family. We really have close-knit families. Mm-hmm. And yes, there's friction between the two generations. Yes, I think our students sometimes want to just retreat to friends and school. And I think that's true for most teenagers
right,
nowadays,
normal.
Right? But also there's, and I know in our church, these wonderful families. I mean, parents really emphasize eating around the table together, spending time with one another. Now, of course, as they get busier, that's harder to do. But I think there are still some of those traditional, you know, kinsmen family values that we have, getting together with other families over the weekend that are still displayed in our youth ministry. And mm-hmm. so, yes, I think students do sometimes just want to go home and rest and hang out at home.
Right. It just kind of reminded me of the book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting at the Same Cafeteria Table? I've suggested that a lot of school districts sometimes call me and be like, what do we do about the Asian kids? Why are they all, you know, and kind of there is that safety too for some kids, not every kid. Again, there's a variety of Asian teenagers, but a lot of times they do feel safe with their own cultural group. They don't realize it. They're bicultural, but and I think the immigrant church, Chinese church, the Asian church, Korean church can be a real safe place for them mm-hmm. because they do feel a lot of ethnic identity that makes them feel safe in their faith or just life in general. Something just to, you know, youth workers can understand too.
You know, I want to back up just a little bit, because one of the things that you did talk about earlier in the first part of our interview was the aspect of shame. And I think that we've kind of circled around that quite a bit. But I would love to hear specifics, because it sounds like the way that we communicate it often is shame is I am a mistake, whereas guilt is I made a mistake. Shame is placing an identity, whereas guilt is I shouldn't have done that. I messed up. And it sounds like the way that you're talking about shame, it's there's so much more of a weight. Like, it even goes beyond identity. I don't know if there's a word that I can quite use, but maybe if you can just piece that out, share a little bit more about when you're talking about shame, what does that look like and what does that mean for an Asian adolescent, for an Asian student?
You know, I think
I stumped them.
Shame. Yeah. No, shame in the Asian versus, you know, Western culture, by definition, is more individualistic. Asian culture is more collective. So when I think of shame, and there's a term called toxic shame, where it's like 1,000 eyes are on you, even though they're not really, you feel the weight of a family and a society and a culture and a church. Even in, you know, and Jody, you know, we talked about this in the break, but she says in her church, they don't announce what college students go to in their banquet, because if you don't go to the right college, you just feel like 1,000 eyes are on you and you didn't measure up. And I had a student who didn't get into an Ivy League school who stopped coming to church for 2 months, who was a very active student. And again, I really believe no one would have shamed her and pressured her. But this weight of the collective society and pressure of others, and even in the church context, is so heavy and huge that, again, we call it toxic shame, where it just literally is poisoning you and affecting you and hurting you. And again, it's a difference between a collective Asian non-Western culture and probably a more individualistic Western culture.
I want to follow up on that, because what I'm hearing you say, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that shame in the Western culture is very individualistic. It's about me and my identity, whereas what you're talking about is that it's shame is a we. So I'm disgracing my family. I'm disgracing I don't know if I'd go as far as my heritage, but is that what you're saying, that it's not just about me, it's about every other person that is, it's my tribe. And so I am letting them down. And so I am carrying the weight of not just my own shame, but that I carry it for every one of these other individuals in my life. Is that a fair way of saying that?
I think in some ways, yes. There is that aspect of we belong to one another. We represent the Asian culture. So there is that idea. I know just on a practical level, is we do see a lot of dropouts from church because the shame is so great that they can't face each other. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they don't want to shame the church or their friends or the family members that might come. So they stop coming because of whatever issues in their life that they feel bring shame. And I do think that that's so important. I think we don't do this as well as we should, but really looking at how Christ came in weakness, mm-hmm. how Christ came as a baby, completely vulnerable and helpless, how Christ ministered to the poor, and how the scriptures say that our power is perfected through weakness. Not through strength, because then when we are weak, it really allows God to work in our lives. So that's the whole faith and culture aspect. And just to know that we are loved by God. And it says, while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. I just keep going back to that song. I know it's played a lot over the radio, Good, Good Father. But he's a good, good father. It's who, you know, it's who I am. And you are loved. It's who you are. So we have a good father, and he is a loving father, and he loves us no matter what. Yes, we have to obey. Yes, there are standards that we need to hold to, but we honor God. We don't honor ourselves through this. So just preaching that message over and over in church contexts, I think, is just so important.
Yeah. And to add on to that, I think, you know, we Jody and I know, I could just hear her, you know, we care about teaching kids identity in Christ. And even though they're bicultural, their ultimate identity is in Christ. I think for people who are not Asian, though, my wife's a counselor, and a lot of times people will ask, why don't they just find their, for Asian people, why don't they just find their identity in Christ? Why can't they find security in Christ? And that's not valuing their story.
Easy.
Yeah, it's not that easy. It's toxic, the shame aspect, and really hearing their deep story and being compassionate and understanding. Again, you know, just find your identity in Christ. It's a lot more deeper and needs to be a lot more openness to understanding why they're struggling. You know, just as much as you struggle with depression, which we're seeing a lot more mental illness, this is a deep issue for many Asians, and it's not easy for them to overcome. I always talk about the movie The King's Speech. You know, you watch that movie and you're like, talk, you know, just talk. And it's kind of like that phenomenon, like, just get over shame, you know, or, you know, it's not that. And even the mental illness issue, we're seeing more of it, but parents are, they don't want to even admit depression and bipolar and schizophrenia. It's just really, in our Asian culture, it's shameful.
Yeah.
They don't want to speak.
Yeah, Danny, you mentioned listening to their stories, but don't you think that we do need to do that, but sometimes it's so hard.
Yeah.
Because even when they are struggling and you try to go visit or you call, they don't want to talk about it.
Right.
So there's that aspect of, yes, we need to listen. And there's aspect of giving space and being really patient in their journey and in this process as they work things out.
Right. So a couple of things I'm hearing here as we turn the corner and finish this up. And this is great. This is really rich and eye-opening. I love listening to the two of you chat to us and with each other. It's really good. But Jody, I hear you saying, well, both of you, I hear you saying, you know, we need to, just like we do with all people, consistently preach the gospel, speak the gospel to the realities that are there. And I also hear a call to listening, which is a big part of relational youth ministry and just letting people tell their stories. You can't, you know, we want to play, I think parents are like this, youth workers are like this. We want to be the Holy Spirit, but we can't drag our kids screaming and kicking into God's kingdom. We can't twist their arm into God's kingdom.
Right.
We need to let the Spirit do the Spirit's work. But beyond that, just very quickly, a couple of suggestions you can leave us with in terms of how to do ministry in this kind of context. Just give us a framework, some parameters. You know, beyond speaking the gospel and listening, is there anything else? Jody, you talked about ministry to parents. Danny, I know that's a huge part of what you do. You know, your book's about that. Give us something here as we finish up. Is there anything else you can suggest?
I think for youth workers to get educated, that's to understand, read up on things, listen to their students, especially their Asian American or their bicultural ones, various ethnicities, talk to them, get educated, and be tireless in building relationships with the parents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think with teenagers, we talked about indirect communication, shame culture. You know, you don't want to burden another person. But I found the old school visitations of kids at school events, band concerts, sports. Mm-hmm. We're not their parents again. I always tell parents, I'm not your parent, but I think the parents value it, you know, because they don't have time, a lot of them. And I think the kids really value that someone's present in their life, even more because of the family cultural difference and all. And I found that really doing all that stuff that we call relational ministry has been pretty effective and powerful, at least in my context in the Asian church.
Well, this is really good. And I, again, this is a conversation I think we need to continue. We're just scratching the surface here. But for many of us, this is really eye-opening. I remember thinking early on in youth ministry, kid is a kid is a kid. And there's some truth to that developmentally in terms of some of the issues that are common among all kids. But every young person has a unique story. And that involves family context. It involves cultural context. And the more that the literal face of our youth groups are changing in terms of the multicultural realities, the more we have to be aware of this and sensitive to this. So I'm going to ask you guys in just a second, and maybe Jason, if you have any recommendations for resources to follow up. But let me mention four here. And I just went in and pulled these four off my shelf. Of course, I'll start with Danny Kwan's book, Youth Workers Field Guide to Parents, Understanding Parents of Teenagers. And Danny, I really appreciate this. A great book, and gets us started in a sensitivity to parents. A couple of books on cross-cultural ministry, and I've read a lot on this just because of what we're doing here at CPYU. Patty Lane has a great book published by InterVarsity Press called A Beginner's Guide to Crossing Cultures, Making Friends in a Multicultural World. We'll include links to all these books on the site. And by the way, we'll include links to, in terms of where you can get these, some, at least one of these I know we have here. Otherwise, we'll send you over to our friend Byron Borger at Hearts and Minds if you'd like to purchase a book from him. And then another book, which is now out in a third edition, published by Baker Books, is by Sherwood Langenfelder and Marvin Myers, missiologists, a book called Ministering Cross-Culturally, A Model for Effective Personal Relationships, which is what we were just talking about. And then I hope this would be helpful, and I don't mean for this to be self-promotion at all, but the principles that I included from Paul's journey into Athens in Acts 17, when he crossed from his culture into the pagan Athenian culture with all their idol worship there, and then when he engages with the Athenians at Mars Hill, I include a lot of that in this book, Engaging the Soul of Youth Culture, Bridging Teen Worldviews and Christian Truth, which I worked very hard in that to communicate good missiological principles for cross-cultural ministry. So I think those books would be a good start. Jason, is there anything you're thinking of, or and then I'll...
Well, I actually was curious about a book that Danny had mentioned during our podcast, which was why do all the black kids sit at the same cafeteria table? Was that a book?
Yeah, it is. I can give you the reference and talk about it. It's really about race and culture and teenagers and things like that.
So, yeah, and we'll look for that and include a link to that.
Yeah,
Danny and Jody, any books you recommend that you think would be helpful for the rest of us as we endeavor to minister cross-culturally?
Well, I have a lighter resource. It's not a book. It's a magazine called Inheritance.
Okay.
And Inheritance tells stories about how Christian faith interacts with Asian and American cultures. It's actually a free subscription. It's written by Asians. It tells their stories. It's very lighthearted, yet very deep, and very insightful into Asian American culture.
And that's something we could all subscribe to.
Yes.
And you recommend that for youth work. That is awesome. I've never heard of that.
That is awesome.
That is great, yeah.
Inheritance.
Oh, yeah, I see the cover there. You're holding it up. We can see them. Yeah, there's an article about in there, Over the Hill, right there on the cover. So that's awesome. Yes.
Yeah,
thanks for being sensitive to me. Danny, anything else you'd recommend?
You know, IV put a little Bible study out on, like, Amazing Grace, Losing Face. I'll get you the link and the exact title. The Bible study, but as a youth worker, you just go through it. It talks a little bit about the cultural issues and the specifics in Asian culture, education. It's an old book, but I think it's just very helpful understanding about Tom Lin, the new national director of IV, who's an Asian American. Asian American now directing, you know, InterVarsity now. He is one of the co-authors of that book. Very interesting. And, you know, I just talk about, you know, what CPYU does in really understanding youth culture. This is what we're talking about. We're just understanding youth culture in a specific way to a specific context. And that's what I really love about what you all do. And I just think you all are a great resource for
Danny,
what we're talking about here.
Thank you.
I agree.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you guys, Danny and Jody, for being a part of this. And let me ask this question. Would it be okay for us to include your email addresses as we post about this podcast? That's maybe not a fair question to ask as we're recording.
You're putting them on the spot, Walt.
Yeah, I am. That's okay, right? I mean, I think that would be a good thing, and maybe folks would have questions they could ask you directly, or they could. You're both on Facebook. People can get you on Facebook. So Danny Kwon, K-W-O-N, Jody Chung, C-H-U-N-G. By the way, she spells her name Jody, J-O-D-I. She's one of those. Can't put the Y at the end. It's got to be the I. I'm just joking. There's nothing wrong with that. Now your mother's going to be really angry with me. I did meet her mom, sweet lady. But what we want to do is encourage folks. I think one of the lessons I'm going to take out of this, and it's interesting, Danny mentioned CPYU, you know, always youth workers, parents, always remain teachable. If you're not realizing as every day passes that you know less today than you thought you knew yesterday, you're not really being teachable. So please work hard to continue to learn and listen to culture, listen to kids. So Danny and Jody, thank you. Jason, thank you again for being a part of this.
That was great.
And we will enjoy chatting with you all again on the next episode of Youth Culture Matters.
Thanks for joining us for Youth Culture Matters, a podcast from the Center for Parent-Youth Understanding. If you'd like to learn more about today's youth culture, visit our website at cpyu.org. And if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, email us at podcast@cpyu.org.